One of them is Chris and Linda. Chris Keeler, my wife had a bond with Chris really early on because we have kids roughly the same age. So we were always changing the experience of what it was like to hold our child the first time. And we always had that bond. But I've always been really inspired by your ability to help people facilitate your change. And I've always viewed that change agent. I've always respected that. From Linda's perspective, a master storyteller. I love her stories. And I really love what she's done with NLP Canada to help a sense of community to really kind of take it to the next level. So without further ado, Linda and Chris.
Now, mostly I let Linda do all the talking, so I figured, why change now?
But I am going to start. Actually, we'll start. We'll start with where NLP started. And it's mostly what you've heard about NLP so far today. Because NLP is a set of practices. It's hands-on. It's not necessarily theoretical. That's why the theory is sort of drifted in all different directions, is because people take their theories. This is hands-on. And it starts with the question, how do we replicate success? How do I get to do what you can do? And if I can do it, if I can do it reliably, if I can do it in different contexts, then I might even have a kind of mastery. And that's where John Grinder and Richard Bandler started NLP. It was about getting to a point of mastery. And it turned out it was relatively direct. First thing you needed to know is what you were trying to do. You needed to have an outcome. And a lot of the people up here have been talking to you about outcomes in all different words, purposes and compasses and directions and goals. But they mean they had something that they wanted to do, something that they wanted to achieve or to have.
And as those of you who have gotten to know Lynn and I presenting together, it becomes painfully obvious that I have a very strong outcome and desire to continually interrupt Linda.
It's true. And he's quite a master.
I mean, it is quite a feat when I can take a strong thinker, a PhD level thinker, and just, you know, leave them speechless.
That's true. Because in part one, you set an outcome, and then you look around the world. Just the way you looked around the world when you were a very small child, and you had to learn as a very small child, without a lot of language, without money, without power, without status, without resources, without all those things that as adults in meetings we tend to say, well, I can't do that because I don't have. As a very small child, what did you do? You said, the whole world is out there for me to learn from. You looked for somebody who could do that thing that you wanted to do. So in NLP, you set your outcome, and then you find either one person who's already getting that outcome, or different people who are getting parts of those outcomes. And you start paying attention. What are those people doing? And maybe even, what are those people doing and how is it leading to that result? And then the part that the NLP books leave out sometimes, I think. They don't like it as much. But if you really want to do it, you have to do it more than once.
You know, that's true.
So you find a role model, you observe the role model, and then you practice. And you practice. And you practice. And you practice. And one day, you wake up like Beth with her back, and you say, you know what, I can do this. I can do it on Tuesday, and I can do it on Saturday. I can do it when it's raining. I can do it when people are with me. I can do it when people are against me. I got it. I have mastered it. And that feels great.
It truly does. When Lynn and I first started working together, we ran a workshop out in Milton. It was how to move a mountain. And it was a writing workshop. And the outcome was, we take people, a group of people, who know nothing or very little about the rules of writing poetry or prose, and trick them through NLP and hypnosis into writing as if they knew the rules of poetry. Sent them off to write.
It was a long time before I knew NLP as a set of practices. I'd done that. I called it studying. And I was good at it.
Fundamentally opposed, by the way. Practicing, I'm good at. Studying, well, let's just...
And while my degree says English literature, what I was doing was studying models of excellence. And for 11 years in university, I studied varying aspects of how people became excellent at modeling humanity through words. Because that's what literature is. A novelist has to be so precise in so many different aspects of conscious and unconscious behavior in order to build a story that will actually speak to all different readers.
Not speaking to the PhDs in the room, could you imagine 11 years of university?
I can.
I'm sure you can.
Now, for six of those years, my focus was a poet called William Butler Yeats, and where did Mark go? Was that the cross in Drumcliff? No, but it could have been that Celtic cross. There's an ancient cross just like that outside the graveyard where Yeats is buried, and I know because my mom, before she was my business manager, said, if you've spent 6 years studying, you should go and see where that guy lived. Sent me to Ireland. Now, Yeats was somebody who was a model of excellence by just about any standard. When he was 7 years old, his father wouldn't let him go to church Sunday morning. He had to stay and have individual tutoring lessons in how to read because he wasn't reading at the age of seven, and his family was worried that he was not too bright. Nonetheless, he went on to win a Nobel Prize in literature and be one of the most studied poets of any time. And if you go to a library, because such things still exist, although students don't go there anymore, there are shelves of books. And when I was there, it was said that there were more books about Yeats than there were books about the Bible. That was only part of his career. He founded a national theater. He became a senator in the Irish Free State. And he was the friend not just of artists, but of people who were alternately heroes or terrorists, depending on your point of view. He was. And he wrote until the day he died. This is a man who knows what excellence is. This is a man who knew what outcome formation was. And near the end of his career, and it was the end of his career that I was most interested in, he wrote a poem, and I'm not going to read you all four stanzas, but I will read you the final one. The first three stanzas are about specific goals he had achieved, and they all end with the refrain that we'll hear. The work is done, grown old, he thought. According to my boyish plan, let the fool's rage I swerved in naught, something to perfection brought. But louder sang that ghost, what then? And that question, what then? It's Plato's ghost, by the way. What then? People think it's so magical. I can set an outcome and I can get it? We go, yes. Yes, you can. I can master something? If you're willing to work hard enough, yes. You cannot just master something using these techniques. You can master this technique. You can master what there is in NLP, because that's what NLP is for. My question has always been, what then?
Which drives me crazy. have the time. Quite often I, when you grab a hold of something that is so a part of you, that you want to develop a level of mastery, it's as insatiable as breathing. Everywhere you look, everywhere you turn, every person you meet, everything you do is geared towards honing that skill. What's the next level? Because there's always a next level. And sometimes you get to a point where you're like, okay, this is nice. I can do this. And then all of a sudden, there's Linda's voice on the other end of the phone. What's next? Are you kidding me? What's next?
Because the people that we admire most, the people that have been innovators and creators, in NLP it's actually Milton Erickson more than anybody else. They didn't have models. They didn't have somebody else that they could look to and say, how do I do this? They had teachers for bits and pieces. They did something new, something different. Even the founders of NLP said, we think there should be something that isn't academic that tells people how to get to excellence. We think we can get there faster than anybody is getting there now. So if we really want to be like our models, at some point we have to give up being masters. Because it's easy to master something that somebody else has already mastered, in relative terms. Here is the hardest thing. When you have achieved mastery, to give it up. It's why they say that the enemy of the great is the good. And today, in your bag, you found a pencil. And you got a pencil because I do the ordering and I like pencils.
I go, yeah, but.
He said, if you're willing to sharpen. And have pencils because I think this is where you go after mastery. You go back to the things you can do with a pencil. And the first thing you do with a pencil is you sketch. Lightly, because what you have beyond this desire for mastery is a desire for something more than mastery. A desire for something that doesn't have a form yet. And the only way you can start figuring that out is to start trying shapes on and saying, does this match this desire that I have for form? Is this going to be a fit? And a pencil is great. In fact, it's famous for sketching things out lightly. And it's important that it's light, because when you're not a master anymore, when you're not the kid who gets to write in ink, your teacher says, no, go back to a pencil for a while. Everybody remember that? Do you remember how much you wanted to be able to write in ink?
Mm-hmm. They came out with those erasable inks.
You need to move lightly because you need the eraser on the end of the pencil. Because the thing about going beyond mastery is you're going to make a lot of mistakes. You're going to screw up. You're going to go down the wrong path, and some days you're going to be sure you're at the North Pole because your compass is clearly not working.
Oftentimes when I was training police officers in using their guns, we had exercises called simunitions where they would shoot soap pellets like 480 feet per second. And we'd set them up in impossible scenarios, and we said that your number one objective is to go out there and make as many mistakes as you possibly can, as fast as you can.
And you can make mistakes on your computer. And on your computer, you can just press delete. And it all goes away. I like pencils because when you erase, you can always tell. Whatever you put after that, you know there was a mistake that you are building on. It's a reminder that our mistakes are part of the process. that we wouldn't be better if we went directly to perfection. The other thing that I actually quite often when I'm doing sample sales presentations with my college students, they talk about selling a pencil. I say it's the perfect tool. Sometimes you have a point, but if you get too worked up about it, or you work too long or too hard or with too much pressure, what happens to the point? Yeah, it breaks. It goes dull and it breaks and your hand gets sore. And you can't write with it anymore anyway because it's dull. It says get up and take a break. Because this is a long path that you're on if you're going to go beyond mastery, if you're going to try and give form to a desire that doesn't have a name or a shape. And you've got to be in it for the long haul, and it's good to have a tool that reminds you too much pressure and you're pointless now.
Of course, when Malcolm Gladwell came out with his whole 10,000 hours to mastery thing, I immediately started calculating all the times that I thought I practiced when maybe I didn't, but I thought maybe I could just make it retroactive and see where I'm at now, and you can't really rush it, I guess.
Now, the people that we're most familiar with, people who chase a form for desire that doesn't have a name or a form are our artists. And we have this whole cliche around artists being self-destructive.
I think writers are like that too.
I was using artists generally.
Oh, general, sorry.
Here's what I've noticed, because there are artists who die young. Flame out. But there are artists that I somehow had the wisdom to study when I was very young. Who don't even get started till they're older. Or who, like Yeats, started writing poetry and publishing in his teens, put together a whole lifetime, another 60 years, of getting up every day and creating something new. Yeats said, "Think where a man's glory most begins and ends, and say my glory was, I had such friends." If you want to go out and play beyond mastery, it's not a safe place to play. It's not easy. You're going to make mistakes. There's going to be too much pressure. There's going to be lots of frustration. And what helps is having good friends. Friends who believe that there is a shape for that desire that you are chasing. Friends who believe that maybe you will find it. And friends who believe that maybe the pursuit is worthwhile in and of itself. That whether or not you get that perfect result. Imagine having the moxie to say, I something to perfection from. That's kind of two jumps above excellence.
See, I had to get her to explain that.
What gets you there is what keeps you going on the path, and what keeps you going on a difficult journey are the friendships you make. We thank you all because by being here today, you are part of our community of friends. And many of you here have been our friends for a long, long time. And some of you have shared our frustrations on the days when we didn't quite get it right. But you keep showing up, and we keep showing up, and we are very grateful for you.
Thank you.